William Stewart Halstead was born in New York City in 1852 at a time when only 50% of children born in this country would live to the age of five. Little was understood about the causes and treatments of infections and diseases, and surgery was usually a risky, hastily performed ordeal. In his career as a surgeon, William Halstead would change the way medicine was practiced and taught. In Genius on the Edge, The Bizarre Double Life of Dr. William Halstead, Dr. Gerald Imber, a practicing plastic surgeon, gives an account of the life and work of the man called the father of modern surgery, including the fact that he was secretly addicted to cocaine and morphine. It's published by Kaplan. I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Imber to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
So what was the state of medicine in the mid-19th century like when Dr. Halstead was born or when he went to medical school?
Well, I think it's even more interesting to ask what the state of surgery was, because medicine had begun to do good things. Surgery was, at best, barbaric. I think it's fair to say that you were just as likely to die from the surgery as you would be to have died from the cause for which you were having surgery.
Well, there were people who were already talking about bacteria as a cause of infection, weren't there? We had Pasteur, we had Robert Koch, we had Ignaz Semmelweis.
They were a little bit later than that. They were all European, and it began perhaps in 1867 with Pasteur and went for the next 10 or 15 years until people actually got the idea that there was something called the bacterial cause for disease. But until then, everyone thought that there were four humors, and depending on the balance of those four humors, you would or would not get infected.
And then there was also Joseph Lister, who came up with the theory that killing germs was important in surgery and in healing wounds.
Correct. That was in 1867, and Lister was a surgeon practicing in Edinburgh, and he used carbolic acid to sterilize the wounds of his patients, and for the first time, people actually began to survive. And for the next 20 years, he proselytized, went all over the world, and nobody believed him.
Really? So Americans continued doing it the way they always had?
They did indeed. And actually, Halstead, in the late 1870s, when he just went into practice in New York City, was so entranced by the idea of Lister's antiseptic surgery, he wanted to take it a step further to aseptic surgery. And he actually built his own operating room in a tent at Bellevue Hospital on First Avenue with money he raised from his family. And it was the first sterile operating room in the world.
What had gotten him into medicine in the first place? Did he come from the kind of family that bred doctors?
There was a doctor in his family, but his family were patrician businessmen. And he grew up in the very fancy neighborhood of Fifth Avenue and 14th Street. And he became a doctor only because he picked up a book about anatomy, Gray's Anatomy, during his senior year at Yale, and actually may have been the first time he'd ever been in the library.
And he was a hospital intern where?
At New York Hospital and at Bellevue.
So he was, I don't know if those were plum jobs at the time, but I've been told that if you graduate at the top of your class in a medical school, you want to be in a hospital like Bellevue or Kings County because you're going to see everything.
Well, that was the case when I was at school. It was the case when Halstead was at school. And it may well be the case now.
What kinds of cases would he have seen on a regular basis?
Well, he was a surgical intern at Bellevue, and he saw primarily fractures. During the time, the 7 months that he was an intern at Bellevue, there were only 200 patients admitted to surgery, and of those, more than 50 were fractures.
And was that a problem? It seems to me fractures are pretty easy to treat, aren't they?
Fractures are easy to treat, especially in the time when anesthesia was present, which it was at that time. But the terrible fracture that separates the men from the boys is called a compound fracture, when the bone breaks through the skin. And there's a terrible incidence of infection in those circumstances and a high incidence of amputation coming from them.
And there was a lot of amputation during the Civil War.
That was it. I mean, the Civil War amputation was the operation most performed. Doctors at the Civil War were most often not even trained as doctors.
What happened with something like an appendix bursting?
Well, an appendix burst, and you either you lived or you died.
You just simply survived the experience.
Or not.
He went to Europe for surgical training. And was Europe much more advanced?
It was, but it was sort of the observation system. There would be somebody doing wonderful things, and if you were lucky, you would get to stand around and watch him do them and then come home and try and do it yourself. Mm. There wasn't a training system. One of Halsted's greatest achievements, his greatest gifts to us, is the system of graduated responsibility in residency training. When you think of someone as a young surgeon, you think of him taking a residency. Halsted invented it.
So he invented it not just for the United States, but for the world. He changed the way medicine was taught.
Yes, exactly.
And pretty much the way it's taught today?
It is taught today precisely the way Halsted taught it, and every surgeon that is worth his salt today can trace his lineage back to Halsted.
But we also, you give me the impression that he was very open to new ideas all the time.
He was a scientist. He was the first surgeon who actually looked at his results and said, now, is there a way to do this better? Before that, that just was unheard of.
What were his discoveries about blood?
Well, his discoveries about blood were interesting and questionable in retrospect. He did the first transfusion. It was a transfusion in which he took blood from himself and injected it into his sister. And there was no cross-matching at the time. And he gave her very little, which may not have saved her at all. And actually, he had likelihood of doing her grave harm because he hadn't cross-matched the blood. But it was the first transfusion. And he also...
And when did they discover that we have different blood types?
That was just after the turn of the century. Landsteiner and Wiener discovered that. But the other thing he did was this... He found that people who were on enclosed systems where carbon monoxide was being generated, like on the ferry boats in the river, would get carbon monoxide poisoning. And he devised a way to take their blood out, shake it in the air, oxygenate it, and re-inject it. And he saved a lot of lives doing that.
Now, he gave his sister a blood transfusion. Did he save her?
It's questionable whether that had anything to do with it. It was a great story, though.
Well, it's also something that doctors are discouraged from doing now, doing any medical treatment on a close relative. He also operated on his own mother, didn't he?
He did indeed. In 1882, his mother was an extremist from an infection in her gallbladder, and he did the first recorded removal of gallstones on his mother on the kitchen table barehanded. I don't know what to say.
Well... Wouldn't he have brought it to the hospital since he was connected to a hospital?
Well, that was in Albany, and he was at Johns Hopkins in New York City at Bellevue and Roosevelt, and no one had done the operation before anyway.
My guest is Dr. Gerald Imber, I-M-B-E-R. His book, Genius on the Edge, The Bizarre Double Life of Dr. William Stuart Halsted, is published by Kaplan. Let's talk about that double life, because the parallel story here is that along with being a brilliant surgeon who changes not only the way surgery is done, we mentioned gowns. When did he introduce those?
Well, he introduced surgical scrub suits. He introduced in the late 1880s, he introduced the use of surgical rubber gloves. He introduced the use of, he introduced the first mastectomy to cure breast cancer. He introduced the hernia operation, the first time hernias were ever cured. He did a great deal.
And all the time he had real serious problems with drugs.
He was addicted to morphine and cocaine throughout his entire career.
Cocaine first?
Yeah, cocaine first.
Wasn't it accepted at the time? In fact, if I remember correctly, Coca-Cola originally had a little bit of cocaine in its formulation. And Sigmund Freud wrote a paper extolling the virtues of cocaine.
Well, Sigmund Freud was really the person who, if you will, got Halsted into this, because Freud was working with a man named Kohler, and Kohler found that cocaine would numb the eye and allow surgery. Halsted read that paper and decided it would be a fabulous local anesthetic, which in fact it was. And he invented local anesthesia and dental anesthesia, but he did his first experimenting on himself and all his staff. Most of them died. All of them became addicted, including Halsted.
Really? But he was just using it as an anesthetic. He wasn't using it as a recreational drug.
I don't think the drug knows what you're using it for. You inject it and you get addicted.
Uh-huh. And he was injecting it rather than snorting it or doing something.
He was snorting it too, because he found it did dry up the sniffles and make him feel better and improve his mood. But as a local anesthetic, it was being injected on himself and all of his students.
Was he the only one doing this sort of thing?
He's the one who brought that, who truly invented local anesthesia at great cost to himself.
When did friends and colleagues realize that he had a problem?
About a year into it, he became totally, his writings became illegible. He stayed up all night talking, and he had all the behavior that one thinks of now as someone addicted to cocaine.
And did he get any treatment for it?
He did. The treatment of the time was very, very advanced, and that treatment was to treat him with morphine so he would get off the cocaine. So he became addicted to both.
He continued to take the cocaine, but the morphine has a very opposite effect.
It does, and Halstead was a bright man, and he was trying to organize his life. And what he did was he took morphine on a daily basis. It allowed him to work. He was nice and peaceful. He didn't have the highs of cocaine. And then on weekends and during his vacation, he would disappear for months at a time and use cocaine.
Well, I've heard, maybe it's apocryphal, but I've heard that there was a fairly high heroin addiction rate among doctors, at least at one point. The reasons were obvious. They were working in a very stressful situation. They had access to drugs, and they knew how to administer it in a way that the street junkie doesn't.
Well, I think that's still the case today. I don't know if heroin is the drug of choice, but most narcotics are available to doctors, and the incidence of addicted doctors is enormous.
Well, how was he able to function? Because, well, cocaine speeds things up, and as you said, it made him slightly mad. The morphine slows you down, if anything. I would think that it would have dulled his reflexes.
Well, it didn't. It apparently didn't dull his reflexes, and he knew how much to take, and he was able to work quite effectively. Some people believe that he changed from being a rapid, you know, cut-and-dash surgeon to a thoughtful, scientific, and safe surgeon only because the morphine changed his personality a bit. There's no real evidence for that, but there is evidence for the fact he could work a full day, use the morphine enormous doses in the evening, come out from behind locked doors and be lovely at dinner, and go about the cycle again.
How long was cocaine used as an anesthetic in medicine?
It was used as an anesthetic in medicine and still is used today, but it was used primarily as a local anesthetic for almost 50 years and is replaced by Novocaine.
Medical science only learned about the problems connected with cocaine and morphine through the tragedies they created. Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night is about his mother, who was given morphine because of pain in childbirth, I think it was.
Then
she became an addict.
But it was available every place. Until the Harrison Act in 1914, it was readily available over the counter. I mean, it was the Southern women took it to deal with the ennui of life.
Meanwhile, despite his private addiction, Halstead starts working with Dr. William Welsh in Baltimore on pretty high-level stuff.
Oh, yeah, Welsh was his best friend and saved him from himself, really. Did the first intervention and brought him down to Baltimore and allowed him to become the first chief of surgery at Johns Hopkins and really invent American surgery there.
So it was Johns Hopkins developed as a hospital to do the things that other hospitals were not doing?
It was. In Mr. Johns Hopkins' will, he left $7 million to establish the finest university with the finest minds in medicine. And Welsh was given that charge, and in fact he did that.
So they institute all of the things that he wants, the changes that we've been discussing, including sterilizing everything.
Everything.
And did people see immediate results?
Immediate results. It changed surgery instantly. And in fact, a few years later, his Halstead's resident, Harvey Cushing, was able to open the skull and do brain surgery because things were sterile now.
I would assume that this just stunned everybody in the medical community, and everybody immediately hopped on the bandwagon.
They did not. Medicine doesn't work that way. We are like trying to turn a freighter.
But I don't understand why. Were doctors not reading the medical journals in those days?
They were reading the medical journals, but medicine, and particularly surgery, has always been just an ego-driven world. that everyone thinks they know best. And in this case, Halsted did know best, and his disciples were the people who brought us to the modern age.
When was sterilization made mandatory in hospitals?
I don't think there was a date that it was made mandatory. It ultimately happened, but...
I'm assuming in different parts of the world at different times.
Yes, but in the East Coast of the United States is where it started, and by the 1900s, it was ubiquitous.
Didn't Halsted also change the environment of the operating room?
He changed the environment of the operating room, the environment in a number of ways, but particularly doctors used to come to work wearing frock coats, which they would hang up outside the door and put on their working coats, roll up the sleeves, and go to work barehanded. He immediately stopped that and had everyone change into what we know as scrub suits. And they were white suits and white sneakers and little caps and ultimately masks and ultimately rubber gloves.
He's not as famous as some of the other people who were involved in this kind of science, people like Koch and Semmelweis, Pasteur, et cetera. Why do you think that is?
Well, they were pure scientists, and Koch's postulates changed the world of bacteriology. Pasteur brought us pasteurization and changed the entire world. But in the world of surgery, it's less than the world of science. But even in the world of surgery, Halsted's unknown, and he's not meant to be.
And do we have any idea? Do you think that his addiction, to some degree, undermined the sense of his accomplishments?
I really don't think so, because his disciples and even the people that taught the people that taught me never even spoke much about his addiction. It was assumed that he had been cured. And he wasn't. It's just that he was so reticent about publicity, and also reticent about his life, that he never patted himself on the shoulder, and he never wanted accolades, and they passed him by.
Was it assumed that all bacteria were pretty much the same and dangerous, or was it discovered that certain bacteria caused certain diseases?
Well, that was Robert Koch. Who discovered the anthrax bacteria and tuberculosis that was caused by the tubercle bacillus. But that was a different world. In the world of surgery, they didn't believe that bacteria did anything.
Mm-hmm. Until when?
Well, I think it was probably 1867 when it started with Lister. But even Lister didn't believe that doctors needed to wash the hands.
Didn't Halsted have a number of very influential students who went on to do great things?
Virtually all of his students went on to do great things. He produced more professors of surgery than anyone else in the world. The science of neurosurgery was begun on his watch. Urology was begun on his watch. Ear, nose, and throat was begun on his watch. He oversaw the scientific change in surgery.
And how long did he work? When did he die?
He died in 1922 at age 70, which is exactly what he had predicted, from gallbladder disease, which is exactly what he had predicted.
Mm. Well, how did you learn about all of his accomplishments? After all, you're a plastic surgeon, not the most respected form of surgery.
I take issue with that immediately, and I spent 13 years training in surgery, and I was a general surgeon first. And the people who trained me, both in California and at the New York Hospital, were trained by the people who were trained by Halsted. Mm-hmm. And plastic surgeons are very respected surgeons.
So this is almost like being a musician, a pianist, who says, well, my teacher studied with so-and-so and so-and-so, and you go all the way back to Brahms.
In any academic world, it's the same.
Dr. Gerald Imber is a well-known plastic surgeon. He's also associated with New York Presbyterian Hospital and is assistant clinical professor of surgery at Weill Cornell School of Medicine. His book, Genius on the Edge, The Bizarre Double Life of Dr. William Stewart Halsted, is published by Kaplan. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
It was nice to be here. Thank you.